Well, anyone who has seen its power will have a very healthy respect for fire. As well as having the ability to cause a lot of damage, fire is also a valuable tool for land management and improving the health of our natural areas. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Two guests today who know a lot about both the risks and the benefits of fire in the environment. Anna Spall is the Wisconsin chapter of the Nature Conservancy's Director of Conservation and Land Management. She has 15 years, I think, experience using prescribed fire to manage native habitats. She also teaches others how to do it. She also helped establish and serves on the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. It's a coalition of governmental agencies, organizations, contractors, and individuals, and they're trying to make the use of prescribed fire in Wisconsin more safe and certainly more effective and accepted. And Hannah, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Also with us today, Jolene Ackerman, who has been with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Wildland Urban Interface Coordinator for about 11 years now. The focus of her work is teaching communities how to live in a wildfire environment and how to prepare their properties and the rural landscape for when a wildfire occurs. And they do that by, they call it FireWise, isn't it, Jolene?
Yep, that's one of our main initiatives.
Thanks a lot for being with us today, by the way. And thank you for Smokey Bear. You brought me a Smokey Bear.
Yes, he's adorable.
he is adorable. I should take a picture and put it up on my Facebook page. We got a little Smokey Bear. It's probably going to find its way to home and 9-year-old daughter Emily's bedroom, be my guess.
Hopefully he'll keep watch over her.
Well, Smokey Bear... I think thanks to Smokey Bear, we have pretty healthy respect for and a healthy fear of forest fires. But when used responsibly, Hannah, as a land management tool, it can do a lot of good.
Absolutely, it can. You know, to put fire in context for the state of Wisconsin, it's estimated that historically, pre-European settlement, when Native Americans were here, that upwards of 10 million acres a year would have burned here in Wisconsin, almost a third of our landscape terrestrially. And over the years, that has really dwindled. And today, very few people actually do burning for cultural reasons, but today we do it for biological reasons. And the landscapes that we work on here in Wisconsin are defined as fire dependent, which means the system evolved over time to be dependent on fire. It needs fire to be the system that it is and to maintain it in that format. So today, we estimate in Wisconsin annually between 30,000 and 40,000 acres a year are burned by resource managers, private landowners, contractors, state and federal agencies combined. And so that's a really large amount of space.
Quite a bit of land.
It's a lot of land that is treated in this way that is very beneficial, but it's very visible. So it's really fun to be here today and to have an opportunity to share the story of fire and the use of it here today.
And I'd sure like to get our listeners to join in, too. Maybe as you listen, I'm wondering if you have used controlled burns for land management or if you've taken precaution to protect your home or business from the fires, and have you maybe even seen the destruction caused by fires? As you drive along Interstate 90, if you know where to look, you'll see some remnants. And I've watched over the years in some areas where there were wildfires and that took place, and watched the change in the scene in that area as the years have gone by. At any rate, I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, we would love to hear from you. And, Jolene, of course, unplanned fires, real danger, obviously. And what are they mainly caused by?
In Wisconsin, 98% of our wildfires can be attributed to humans. They may be directly caused by people, or they're a result of a man-made construct like a power line where a person may not have caused that fire, but the man-made power line was the cause of the fire.
So the power line goes down or something and sparks a fire.
Yeah, correct. Last year, I remember we had a big fire caused when a squirrel was on a power line, and mm-hmm. He got zapped, and little fiery fur ball hit the forest floor, and it ignited a wildfire below. So sometimes some anomalies occur, but we attributed it to the power line.
And Hannah was talking about, we do about 30,000 acres or thereabouts of controlled burns. How many of the bad burns do we get, the wildfires?
Well, I can speak to about half the state. Uh-huh. The Department of Natural Resources was responsible for initial attack on in what we call intensive and extensive parts of the state, and that's about half the state, primarily the forested parts of the state. And there we see about 1,300 wildfires burning about 3,000 acres each year.
Oh, 1,300.
1,300, yeah. I think a lot of people listening right now might be surprised by that number.
That's a lot.
It's actually even higher when you think about the other half of the state, which is outside of DNR protection, which we consider the co-op part of the states, where the fire departments go in for initial attack. Those numbers can actually double in the other half of the state due to their primarily grassy nature. Fires tend to get bigger and move faster in our grassy areas.
Yeah, sure. So it behooves us, obviously, to really take care with it. Jane in River Hills actually has a question for you. Jane, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks. So I live in a suburb in Milwaukee County, and I have about an acre property that I want, well, 4 acres, but I wanted to have to do a controlled burn, and I don't know, I guess I can call my area to see if it's possible, or do you know if there's any groups, let's say fire departments or other, that would want to use land to do a controlled burn?
Okay, Hannah, let's turn to you.
Yeah, I can provide a little bit of information on that. There's sort of two parts to when landowners are thinking about burning. And the first side to look at is just the legality side of it and make sure that you have the appropriate permits and permissions to do burning. And a great place to get that information, if you just go to the Wisconsin DNR webpage, it's dnr.wi.gov, and search for fire. That will link you to some great information on where you need to procure any kind of permits for. In your part of the state, it's mostly going to be from local units of government to get permission. The other resource I would connect you to is the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council webpage, and the webpage for that is prescribedfire.org, and that is a coalition of people in Wisconsin who are interested in prescribed fire, and the group works collectively to connect resources for anybody interested in fire. And a great resource on that webpage is a list of contractors and resources of individuals who implement prescribed fire. And so as a private landowner, you could go to that page and get a list of contractors that implement burns in the area. And just start to connect your resources and information. I think that would be a great place for you to start.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, thanks. That's really useful.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anna Spall of the Wisconsin Chapter of the Nature Conservancy, Jolene Ackerman of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guest today as we talk with them about prescribed burns. And again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. Let's talk for maybe Hannah, you can talk about, start on this, some of the positive impacts of a controlled burn. I would assume, for one thing, it would reduce the risk of a major conflagration, you might say, a major fire.
Absolutely. There's a variety of reasons why, as natural resource managers, we like to implement burns today. I think, as Larry referenced, one of the key reasons is that if you do a prescribed fire, you've removed or significantly reduced the available fuel that may be there for a wildfire in the future. So regular prescribed fires can help reduce that fuel loading and either at a small scale, prevent a wildfire from being in that area, or later when a wildfire does go through that area, it's likely to be much less intense and cause less damage to mature trees and certainly if there's a wildfire in an area and it burns into an area that has been burned recently, that's an area where suppression resources can put out a fire. So fuel management is one reason. But so many of us are dealing with woody invasive species and herbaceous weeds. And anybody who does land management, many landowners and nonprofits and agencies out there are familiar with this. There's lots of different ways to approach how to manage invasives. But in vast majorities of Wisconsin, because the area is dependent on fire and used to having fire, you can put fire through it to be good for the native species, but those invasive species often do not like fire. And so with honeysuckle, buckthorn, multiflora rose, and a variety of herbaceous species, when you burn, it can really set back those species and make them much more manageable with other means. So fire plays a key role as one of the tools to help control a lot of invasives. Another key component, it really improves a lot of the habitat for a lot of game species, like turkey, and it improves the habitat for a lot of native species and threatened and endangered species, too, that really need the habitat that gets maintained by fire. And so there's sort of multiple different reasons why fire is, although not a completely magic bullet to solving all of natural resource management, without it, it's really
creates
hard
problem.
To do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tom and Boscobel, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Say, I'm curious about the animals. Two quick questions. The animals first, are they able to get out of the way? Do they benefit from the rejuvenated biosystem? And secondly, I assume there are pressures on how you respond to fires. Biologically, you would probably like to let them go, but I assume there are political and economic pressures that you have to respond. Could you address those?
Yeah, thanks for calling. Good questions. Hannah, we'll turn to you.
Yeah, I can address the first question. Animals are amazingly perceptive to fire, and they seem to be aware that fire is coming through an area before it does. And animals that have the ability to fly away. Animals that are in burrows burrow in, and they get into their underground homes. And larger animals like deer do a very successful job of just removing themselves from the area that that the fire is in. It's very, very rare that I've seen incidental take of game and animal species. But certainly that it can happen. And certainly with, say, for example, nesting birds, a lot of people ask questions about that. And a nest of ground nesting birds is likely to be damaged by fire. However, a lot of bird species, if their first nest is unsuccessful, will go ahead and make a second attempt, likely in an area that hasn't been burned nearby, but will still produce a successful nest that season. We treat threatened and endangered species a little differently. If they're highly sensitive species, there's a great resource through the Department of Natural Resources. They've developed incidental take guidelines for threatened and endangered species, and it helps put some guidelines about percentages of area to burn and times of year to burn. So that can be really helpful on that. But really, by and large, animals have adapted in a fire system for many years, and they have ways of escaping and getting out and protecting themselves as a species. And I'll let Jolene take the second half of the question.
Yeah, Jolene Ackerman, what do you think? Yeah. On the political side of things, sort of.
The political side of things. Well, I can say right off that an option to just let a fire burn is, we just don't have that option in Wisconsin. It's called a let it burn policy. We don't have that. All fires in Wisconsin are put out as quickly and as safely as possible. And I will say that it's largely due to our fragmented lands and the multiple ownership patterns. We don't really have an opportunity like they do out in the West, where there's millions of acres of public land which can be allowed to burn for a while for multiple benefits. Our expanses of public lands just don't go that far. And also, our fires in Wisconsin tend to be very fast. They're wind-driven, and the unpredictability of the weather in Wisconsin being wind-driven fires really requires us out to put them out as quickly and as safely as possible.
And that makes very good sense. Hannah Spall of the Nature Conservancy, Jolene Ackerman of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about prescribed burns today with Hannah Spall of the Wisconsin chapter of the Nature Conservancy. She directs conservation land management and done it for 15 years for the chapter. Also with us, Jolene Ackerman with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She is the Wildlife-Urban Interface Coordinator for the past 11 years for the DNR. So great to have both of them with us. Thank you so much for listening in as we talk with them today about prescribed burns. Bob and Cable had a question. Let's go to Bob. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. How much? I got a question and a comment. The question is, how much does logging, even like a clear cut, how much does that mimic a burn, you know, biologically? I'm driving through between Hayward and, you know, Ashland right now, and there is so much mature forest up here. There needs to be more logging. Even Dr. Deere said the habitat in Wisconsin has gotten so old, if you will, the forests. Hmm. Why isn't there more logging and more prescribed fires, like up here in an area where the land isn't so fragmented? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling, Bob. Let's start with Hannah Spall. Hannah?
That's a great question. You know, the role that logging does, it's, I would describe it from an ecological perspective as it provides disturbance. It provides a change in an otherwise somewhat static system. And so for certain parts of the state, logging today can really provide that disturbance in a very beneficial way, because fire is a disturbance, and it provides that sort of removal of fuel and a rejuvenation. It gets a lot more light down to the ground, so certain species that are at the understory layer may respond better. And so in some ways, logging can provide that. It doesn't work for all ecosystems, and it doesn't work for all parts of the state or certainly across the nation. But I'll give a great example. Oak woodlands today in Wisconsin have a much higher density of oak trees on them than they ever did historically. And so that has largely happened because fires haven't been going through those oak woodlands, keeping the number of oaks in check. So today we have a lot of oaks that are all the same age, very densely packed together. And logging is a definite tool to reducing the density of trees, allowing more light to get down to the ground. And if applied in combination with fire, can really play an almost magical role to get new oak trees to regenerate and get a lot more diversity in the understory. But it doesn't work in all systems. So some places in, for example, more northern Wisconsin that have a more mature forest on them may not be in an area of Wisconsin that evolved over time to be fire dependent. It might it could be areas that just have a much older and more age diverse tree structure to it. In that case, perhaps logging would be a good reason for timber values, but it may not have the same ecological impacts that one would want out of a fire. So it really depends on the ecosystem. And I would highlight that oak forest as a great example of where logging could provide a good mimicry and combination with fire. But I would be very hesitant to necessarily apply that across all landscapes.
Yeah, but a lot of trees and plants do depend on fire.
They do. When you run a prescribed fire through an understory area, it removes all the leaf litter and the a lot of the above ground duff. And that means more light can get down to let native seeds germinate and desirable trees germinate, like oak trees.
Yeah. And oaks actually, if I'm not mistaken, their bark is kind of not fire retardant, but fire sort of resist fire a little bit.
They do. They have a very corky bark to them, a very thick, chunky bark. And when a fire moves through an oak stand, it might create a little bit of scarring around the base, but the fires don't kill the trees by and large. You will get a few incidental ones that die, but overall, mature oak trees are very, very resistant to fire. Jack pine trees are another example. Shagbark hickories are another. So there's a whole suite of species throughout Wisconsin that we see all over the place that are very resistant to that fire.
And you take a tree like a bur oak, for example, a beautiful trees, and it's kind of, I'm kind of glad that they're a little resistant to fire, because you get a stand of bur oaks, or even oftentimes you'll get one sitting out in the middle of a field somewhere. It just creates such a beautiful, makes for such a beautiful part of the landscape.
It does indeed.
Yeah, it does. We had a Wisconsin Life feature that we did, and it had to do with a bur oak, actually. Photographer Mark Hirsch took daily photos on his iPhone of a bur oak tree near his Platteville home. And he got going on this project, called it That Tree, and it attracted followers from around the world. And I have a little feature on that. We have a little feature on that from Wisconsin Life. He shared his project and how the tree had changed him. So let's listen to that.
If people, if they look at my pictures and they see the precarious existence this tree lives under, I mean, that it's there to this day is an absolute miracle. You know, it's on the fringe of a monoculture of corn and soybeans. The farmer has to work to get his combine around it. But I look at that tree and I look at the fact that it's still there, and I always had a great appreciation for the land and I loved it, but I never looked at bur oaks with the same level of appreciation that I have today. And there's a great Aldo Leopold quote that I can't recite to you right now, but it talks about being a wealthy man, he who has a bur oak on their property. And I read that and I just think it's so true. Lucius Lyons was the surveyor that was sent by the Federal Land Survey in 1834 to survey that property, and he was a really creative writer and a really articulate surveyor, and that his observations and his appreciation for the land, it really comes through in the way he described things. And I'm reading this and he's talking about oak savanna, and he's talking about oak trees, he's using trees as points of reference. And here I am today, you know, it's not a witness oak. It wasn't there when Lucius Lyons was there, because since that time then a geologist came out and did a core sample and determined that the tree is 163 years old, but still it's a very old oak tree, and it's witnessed an incredible era in Wisconsin's history following the title and ownership of that property. And the first owner of that property was John Hawkins Roundtree, and who's pretty famous in Wisconsin history. I think he's essentially responsible for forming Platteville. And reading this, I mean, I'm just, it's incredible. It's a beautiful tree. I mean, it's just got a lovely form to it. Every day was a fresh view for about 2 weeks. Then it started looking the same. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? How am I gonna carry this forward? I mean, I've never looked so long and hard and considered at anything in my life. And the outcome is so many cool discoveries. I mean, I'd been seeing the world through kind of blinders. And I started to slow down. Something the people that know me would say I'm not very good at. I tend to move at Mach speed, and this whole process, you know, was kind of transformative. I became more contemplative about my goals visually. I became more observant. I became more emotionally attached to the realm in and around this tree. As a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, I wouldn't have hesitated to roll around in the grass. I wouldn't have hesitated to look closely at a bug. I wouldn't have hesitated to appreciate the way that the hoarfrost forms on the ridge of an oak leaf laying in the grass. But you become an adult, and that's unacceptable behavior, social norms. But my perception now is in the reverse, that it made me feel comfortable living my life and acting like a kid again, and to heck with anybody else that doesn't realize that they should be doing the same.
That's kind of cool, wasn't it? You can see photos from Hirsch's That Tree project on wisconsinlife.org. And I'm sure Judith has got that up on our Facebook page, wisconsinlife.org. It was produced by Erica Janik and produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. So go to wisconsinlife.org and you can find out some more. And Hannah, 160 years ago, he's talking about? Did we have prescribed burns 160 years ago?
Well, you know, that the one oak that he features, it's really referencing what 160 years ago, 163 years ago, would have been a part of what we call today as an oak savanna. Very scattered, open-grown oaks with a prairie grass native understory to it. And when Wisconsin was settled, there were over 5 million acres of that type of oak savanna habitat.
Wow.
And today, because of agricultural conversions and different uses, there remains only a fraction of that, a few thousand acres left today of that oak savanna community. Fires were still running through the area 150, 200 years ago. It was still in cooperation. As settlers moved here, they were still burning because they saw Native Americans burning. And there was a period of time when the newer settlers were burning. Just to clear things out, the threat of wildfire in this part of the area was a great threat. If you just established your home and a wildfire came through, all of your crops and your home could be destroyed. So they knew that if you did some forethought of lighting fires, that you could help protect from that. And that culture has slowly, over the decades, just dwindled and dwindled, and made a transition in the early 1900s to suppress all fire. All fire is bad. And so it's really fun to be a part of a community today that is talking about, no, not all fire is bad. Some fire is really good, and let's figure out how to figure out ways to get it back on the landscape again. It's sort of like it was in fashion, and then it went out of fashion, and now it's back in fashion.
Very cool. Dave in Augusta has a comment, and let's go to Dave. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Nice talking to you here. In the 70s, I used to work at the UW-Madison Arboretum, and I was introduced to a burr oak tree called the Jackson Oak, which at that time was probably 150 years old. That was just a magnificent tree. It was standing at the edge of the Curtis Prairie off McCaffrey Drive.
Yeah.
It was just, it was there when Aldo Leopold first started developing the Arboretum back in the 20s and 30s. Anyway, sad to say, I believe that the tree, last time I was in Madison, I took a drive through the Arb, and I believe the tree is probably in its final stages of life. But, what a magnificent tree. It was just the history that tree could tell. And also we did controlled burns on the Arboretum and at the Curtis Prairie and the Green Prairie. When I first did it with Gene Moran, who was a friend of George Vukelic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought that, what are we doing to the beautiful prairie, you know? But then after 2 to 3 weeks after the controlled burn, you could see the native species coming up, and I found out that the native species have a longer and deeper root system than the invasive species, which is another reason to burn. So,
Very good points. Jolene, a comment on that?
Actually, that brings me back. When I was in graduate school, I actually did research at the Arboretum for my master's thesis, and I was working on the restoration of a couple of degraded oak savannas, one in the Grady Tract and one over at the Lost City, and we too used prescribed burns in there. So you actually took me on a little trip down memory lane there of my time spent at the Arboretum.
And as Dave says, though, I mean, it looks like heck when looks like hell, you could say, even once it, you know, when it first goes through, but it doesn't take long, and you start to say, wow, what a difference.
You know, it's amazing. You can sometimes see vegetative regrowth if you do a spring prescribed fire. Even within 48 hours after a burn, you can start to see tiny little green shoots responding if you get a couple of warm, sunny days. And, you know, I think beauty in nature is objective and subjective, and it depends what someone's perspective is on it. And personally, I find an area that has just been burned and is just coming up with those green shoots just to be stunningly beautiful.
Yeah.
And it is so fun to go out and see things grow day by day and respond. You know, I'll direct folks to another website that has some great photos and just kind of learn a little bit more about prescribed fire if you're interested. It's the Nature Conservancy's website here in Wisconsin. And if you go to nature.org/Wisconsin fire, you can see some of those new regrowth pictures right after burns and learn a little bit more about it. But
that's wonderful. And we actually have, you've mentioned several websites, and we have every one of them. Judith's got every one of them up on our Facebook page. So if you're missing any of those and you want to get to them, just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can click right, we'll link you right to those. And frankly, I can recall, and I'm going to go to your site because I haven't seen those. I can recall though on going online at some point and there were some photos of a national park where there had been a big burn. And so there was before and then during the fire and then right after the fire and then a year or so later. And it was like, what a beautiful, beautiful sight. That's just wonderful. So you've got some of the same kinds of pictures up on your site.
And yes.
All right. Well, I'm going to go take a look. You should, too. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'll get you a link right there. Brahm in Floodwood, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hey, good morning, yeah.
Yeah, good morning.
I wish this program would last for about 3 days because I think I'd learn a lot and I think I've got a lot to offer. But I spent 38 years in the Minnesota DNR in state parks, and I designed and conducted the first prescribed burn on grassland in 1972. And it worked marvelously. But spring burns, good, bad. You can't be that simple. You can do as much damage by a spring burn as you can be constructive. What specific topic I'd like to ask your guest to deal with is the relationship between prescribed burn or any kind of burning, especially grassland, on the problem with Lyme disease and ticks. I do know that fire can basically shut down deer tick population. And over history, if you carry it back a couple of hundred years, there was a reason we didn't have Lyme disease all over the country, and that's because natural fires.
Well, thanks for calling, Brahm. Appreciate it. Hannah, a comment from you?
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on that. And I'm just fascinated. It's great to hear from a caller who was doing burns in 1972, because I think that's when the sort of modern fad in the area really started to pick up again and people started doing burning. So it's that's a great story. You know, my experience of areas that have been burned is that it does have a decreased tick population to it. But that can be short-lived. The ticks will repopulate pretty rapidly. I would imagine it has something to do with just killing, adult ticks, but also impacting egg and larva of them as well. But there's a lot of things that interact with the prevalence of Lyme disease and ticks, including the mouse that carries them so prevalently, mm-hmm. and other animals like deer. Densities have also been associated with higher increased population or sampling of Lyme's disease. So I think Lyme's is a really complicated species or disease, and ticks are a complicated species. And I do believe that fire plays a role in their management, mm-hmm. but I don't think that the scale at which, even if we were able to do 5 times the amount of burning that's happening in Wisconsin today, which is definitely needed ecologically. I think in all likelihood there would still be high populations of ticks and Lyme's prevalence, but yeah. Fire could definitely decrease it, I believe.
And I want to thank you, Brahm, for calling. I appreciate it. We're getting closer to time out here, and I want to definitely, we have questions from Nate and others. How do you get involved with organizations that conduct prescribed fires? Where do you get training to actually do a prescribed fire? What's the background on that?
I think I can give a couple of references. I would really encourage people to look at that Prescribed Fire Council webpage. That has links to training opportunities in the state, and there are a fair number. Depending upon what your interest level is, short one-day courses to extended multi-day courses. So for people that are interested in learning about fire and getting involved and connected, I would also suggest looking at the, there's a consortia for the Eastern Tallgrass Prairie and Oak Savanna Fire Consortia. It focuses on sharing information and resources related to fire in the upper Midwest. With regard to training and where to get training, I think that just brings the, I'd love to just talk a little bit about the safety of burning. And while there are many excellent professionals and private landowners and volunteers working on prescribed fires in the state, it is important to get some training and do some research before going out and just implementing a burn. The individuals who are burning in Wisconsin, for the most part, have taken extensive training, had extensive mentorship. Most people, and certainly all agencies and government entities and the Nature Conservancy, we write a really detailed burn plan that's describes how the operation will go mm-hmm. and the resources that are needed to conduct the burn. We wear protective equipment. Part of the plan has a weather prescription, so picking the right day to do a prescribed fire is probably the most important part of the whole thing, because the right day makes things go very smoothly. The wrong day could make things go very poorly. And so if people are interested in learning, I think those are some great web pages to just start getting connections and starting to find out who they can talk to get more information. There are a lot of resources in Wisconsin for that. Wisconsin's unique that there are dozens of private contractors who specialize in providing burn services. And so they will be able to give information in the context of helping to pick the right day, the safe day, the resources that are needed to do it. And mm-hmm. it's because of that that prescribed burning can be such a safe tool for land management and so successful.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Jolene, by the way, Tim, a quick question. Do you know if the Avoca Prairie is going to be slated for a burn? Or
I don't know that offhand. What I would suggest that Tim does is go to our website, dnr.wi.gov, and enter the keyword prescribed burn, and that lists the state lands that are planned to be burned yet
this
spring.
Perfect. Thank you both very much. I hope we have a chance to do this again. I learned a lot.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Hannah Spall is with the Wisconsin chapter of the Nature Conservancy. She directs conservation and land management for them. And also Jolene Ackerman, who's been the Wisconsin DNR's Wildlife Urban Interface Coordinator for 11 years. So obviously these two are very well trained and know what they're talking about. And I really hope you will go to the websites that Hannah brought up, because they're just a wealth of information there. And even if you're not going to do a burn, I think, to be perfectly honest, I think it'd be worth a look. It'd be well worth a look just for your own information and edification. Well, we're going to switch gears coming up next and talk with an old friend, Amy Stewart, who's authored many a book, including the one we're going to be talking about next. It's got a strange name. It's The Drunken Botanist. Stay with us. It's going to be a lot of fun, I can tell you that for sure. Larry Wheeler here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.